scripture reading this morning is from Matthew 26, verses 26 through 46. Now, as they were eating the Passover meal, Jesus took bread, and after blessing it, broke it and gave it to the disciples, and said, "Take, eat, this is my body." And he took a cup, and when he had given thanks, he gave it to them, saying, "Drink of it, all of you, for this is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins. I tell you, I will not drink again of this fruit of the vine until that day when I drink it new with you in my Father's kingdom." And when they had sung a hymn, they went out to the Mount of Olives. Then Jesus said to them, "You will all fall away because of me this night. For it is written, 'I will strike the shepherd, and the sheep of the flock will be scattered.' But after I am raised up, I will go before you to Galilee." Peter answered him, "Though they all fall away because of you, I will never fall away." Jesus said to him, "Truly I tell you, this very night, before the rooster crows, you will deny me 3 times. Peter said to him, "Even if I must die with you, I will not deny you." And all the disciples said the same. Then Jesus went with them to a place called Gethsemane, and he said to his disciples, "Sit here while I go over there and pray." And taking with him Peter and the 2 sons of Zebedee, he began to be sorrowful and troubled. Then he said to them, "My soul is very sorrowful, even to death. Remain here and watch with me." And going a little farther, he fell on his face and prayed, saying, "My Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will." And he came to the disciples and found them sleeping. And he said to Peter, "So could you not watch with me 1 hour? Watch and pray that you may not enter into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak." Again, for the second time, he went away and prayed, "My Father, if this cannot pass until I drink it, your will be done." And again he came and found them sleeping, for their eyes were heavy. So leaving them again, he went away and prayed for the third time, saying the same words again. Then he came to the disciples and said to them, "Sleep and take your rest later on. See, the hour is at hand, and the Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of sinners. Rise, let us be going. See, my betrayer is at hand." The word of the Lord.
There's a lot of famous last words that people said before they died. Sometimes the famous last words before death are ironic or amusing. Oscar Wilde, before dying, was reported to have said, "My wallpaper and I are fighting a duel to the death. One or the other of us has to go." Voltaire, who was a critic of the church, was asked by a priest on his deathbed to renounce Satan, to which Voltaire replied, "My good man, this is no time to make new enemies." Sometimes the statements that are made before somebody dies are not amusing, but powerful. We see that portrayed in the movie when William Wallace is dying, being executed, and cries out, "Freedom," in the movie Braveheart. In real life, many people gave their life for causes, and in the Christian faith, many martyrs gave their life with great words of power and trust and courage before they gave up their last. Polycarp was one who was going to be burned at the stake, and he refused to be bound to the stake. He said before he was killed, "God, who strengthens me to endure the flames, will enable me to stand firm at the stake without being fastened. You don't need to tie me up." Thomas Becket, before he was attacked by knights and killed, said, "I am ready to die for my Lord, that in my blood the church may obtain liberty and peace." And the great beginners of the English Reformation, Latimer and Ridley, friends, they were going to be executed by burning in Oxford. And as both of them were standing there, tied to the stake with the fire coming up, Latimer was reported to have called out to Ridley, "Play the man, Master Ridley. We shall this day light such a candle by God's grace in England as I trust shall never be put out." And then we read Jesus' words in Gethsemane. words of distress and despair, begging his friends to spend time with him, desperately pleading with the Father, take this cup from me. And I think that if we're going to have a little bit of a critical mind, we need to ask why. Why was Jesus in such agony and despair when so many others went to such similar deaths with stoicism or seeming courage? At the very least, it's a little bit confusing. Why did Jesus, on the night before he was crucified, need to pray, let this cup pass from me? For the past year, he had been talking all about going to Jerusalem to die. He had very clearly stated that he would be crucified. So why, on the night before, is he saying, let this cup pass from me, when he knows good and well this is the very thing he came to do? Others in history have read Jesus' words, his deep distress, and found it horribly embarrassing. Why is it that Jesus seems to lack courage here, when others have died horribly with far greater courage, it would seem? Unless there is something more going on here. Unless there's something that we can see in what Jesus is doing and saying that gives us an insight into why what Jesus was about to face was something that had never been faced before and would never be faced again. I think it's in Jesus' prayer that we get a picture of what Jesus is pointing to in his great agony and despair. Why he is so desperate for his disciples, his best friends, to be with him. Why he says he is overwhelmed with grief and distress. Why his pleading prayer with the Father. As we look at Jesus' prayer and his actions and words here in Gethsemane, I think that what we are pointed to is a deeper suffering and pain than simply crucifixion. And what we get is a picture of a Jesus that is very human, one that we can relate to, and one that does something for us that we need done, something we cannot and don't want to ever have to face ourselves. So let's open up this passage and see how we get a picture of Jesus that might be a little bit fresh, but it's standing on something that the church has stood on for years, that Jesus needed to die, and what he did was altogether different. So we see, first of all, Jesus' absolute humanity in this passage. We see him desperate for his friends to be near him, don't we? This is part of his humanity that's coming out. He gathers his disciples after the Last Supper, and they're heading out to Gethsemane, which is a olive garden outside of Jerusalem. And as the disciples are walking, Jesus talks about how the disciples are going to fall away and betray him. And he gets to Gethsemane and he says to the disciples, sit here while I go over there and pray. And then he takes his closest friends, Peter, James, and John, and says, but you guys stay near me. Watch, remain with me, be awake, stay with me. What we see here is a picture of Jesus who is desperate for companionship. You see, he's about to endure the greatest challenge of his life, and he wants his closest friends to be right there with us. And we understand this, even if we've never had to go through something horribly challenging. We understand that we are made for interdependence. We are not made to do this thing called life alone. Life is a team sport, not a solo sport. And we see that when things go well. When things go well in our life, we want our closest friends and family to be there to celebrate with us. And when things go poorly, we also want them there. We want their hands. We want their presence. I've heard people ask, what do I do when they find that somebody they know has lost a family member to death or to tragedy? And one of the simplest things to do is simply to show up. Just be present. In a time of suffering and of tragedy, just to know that you aren't alone is incredibly powerful. And for any of you who have worked in hospitals and seen the ministry of presence and also seen the absence of it when somebody is there suffering and dying and there's nobody there to visit them, Jesus simply wants his disciples, his best friends, to be present. But of course, as he has predicted, you will all fall away. Peter, before this night is over, you are going to deny that you even know me three times. And in Gethsemane, his closest friends cannot stay awake with him. They fall asleep, and when the soldiers come, they abandon him. To be abandoned and failed by his closest friends. These are Jesus' family. This is like my wife and kids, my parents and sister, my best friends. These are the people who had lived life with Jesus, and they, in his deepest, darkest hour, abandon him. And we see in this picture, the picture of the humanity of Jesus, a Jesus that we can relate to. You know, I've heard people who have met celebrities, whether it's politicians or athletes or movie stars or musicians, and what they've said when they've had a conversation with them, I've heard this one, is he's a really normal guy. And what they mean is they've had enough of a conversation with the celebrity to realize that they have likes and interests just like everybody else. And so that's why a president might fill out an NCAA bracket, so that we can relate to him. Or the former president liked to watch football, so we can relate to him. He's a normal guy. But when you're really talking about relating to somebody, it's a step beyond just that we all have shared interests. I think that you really find somebody is normal and human when you see them in weakness and struggle. When you see that they also have insecurities or challenges or fears. And when you go to that level with anybody, it begins to open up a whole world of humanity that all of us can relate to. Because none of us is an impenetrable fortress. We all stand on very shaky ground. Jesus, here in Gethsemane, is displaying the fullness of his humanity. And we can know, any of us who deal with suffering and struggle and difficulty, that Jesus can identify with us. Jesus identifies with people who are sorrowing and grieving. He knows what it's like to lose the one closest to you. Jesus knows what it's like to deal with anxiety and pressure that leads to almost overwhelming despair, just as many of you have dealt with. Jesus knows very well what it's like to be lonely, to have everyone around you abandon you. No one there when you're going through the hardest times. We often, in our self-pitying stages, say, "No one understands me. No one knows what it's like to go through what I'm going through." And while it may be true that the people around you don't, the Jesus of Gethsemane says, I do. I understand deeply what you're going through. Jesus, we read in verse 37, enters into Gethsemane, and he began to be sorrowful and troubled. Matthew uses two verbs here that are synonyms, and whenever you compound verbs or adjectives in the Greek, it is an amplifying of the meaning. In other words, he is sorrowful and troubled is really saying he's extremely sorrowful. He's overwhelmed, completely undone, extremely agitated and anxious and desperate. As he says a verse later, "I am sorrowful to the point of death," meaning the stress and grief that I am currently under may be enough to kill me by itself. And so we ask, why was Jesus dealing with such sorrow and distress? And it seems like the most obvious answer is what he was about to face 12 hours later, the scourging and the crucifixion. I don't know much about psychology, but I can guess that in the psychology of anticipating pain and suffering, I too would have a lot of sorrow and grief and anxiety. I mean, you see it in kids who are afraid to enter the doctor's office because the last time they were there, they had a shot. And they have this deep anxiety of entering the room, or some of us as adults still do with dentists, right? There's that anxiety of anticipating pain. And so I can imagine that. I can imagine being in Jesus' steps and thinking very well, knowing what tomorrow was going to hold, being very aware of what Roman crucifixion looked like, and being overwhelmed, ready to just run away, if not pass out, at the sheer anxiety in anticipation of that physical pain. But of course we have to ask, but didn't others in history die torturous deaths with far more stoicism and far more courage? People were crucified by the Romans all the time. It's possible they killed tens of thousands this way. During the siege on Jerusalem in 70 AD, anybody who exited Jerusalem was crucified. At one point, one of the historians said, up to 500 people a day were being crucified outside of Jerusalem so that they could not find a place to put a cross anymore. Why was Jesus so overwhelmed and afraid when so many others dealt with the same sort of thing? And this is what he was called to do anyhow. I think that Jesus' prayer to the Father in verse 39 shows us that there's more than the fear of physical pain and suffering that overcame Jesus. What was Jesus' prayer? We read it there in verse 39. Jesus fell to the ground and he prayed, "My Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me. My Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me." Now we assume, naturally, that the cup that Jesus wanted to pass from him was the cross, was dying by crucifixion, the horrible death that he was about to face. But the cup is a common Old Testament metaphor. It's a common Old Testament metaphor for the justice and wrath of God. Let me read a couple of the passages where the cup is talked about in the Old Testament. And look at I'm going to highlight some of the word pictures that are associated with the cup. And I think this is the cup that Jesus is referencing in his prayer when he says, "Take this cup from me." In Isaiah 51, we read, "The cup of God's wrath is the cup of staggering. It is a cup of devastation and destruction. It is full of the wrath of the Lord, the rebuke of God." Listen to some of the words that come out of Jeremiah 25. "This is the cup of the wine of wrath. They shall drink it and stagger and be crazed because of it. As they drink it, it will make them a desolation and a waste, a hissing and a curse. They will fall and rise no more. Disaster. The Lord has an indictment against the nations. The Lord is entering into judgment with all people. So wail and cry out. You will fall. There is no refuge nor escape." And then in Ezekiel, "You shall drink the cup of wrath that is deep and large. You will be laughed at and held in derision, filled with sorrow, because it is a cup of horror and desolation. You shall drink it and drain it out and gnaw its shards and tear your chest, because you have forgotten me, the Lord, and cast me behind your back. You yourself must bear the consequences." Jesus says, "Let this cup pass from me." The cup that he's talking about is the cup of God's wrath on all sin. And you see in the prophets are searching for words to do justice to the magnitude of God's wrath. It is so great, they're searching for words, trying to find the right words to put to words this thing that they're getting a picture of God's wrath coming down on humanity. And so they throw out words like desolation and sorrow and horror. And in some way, this is what Jesus is about to enter into. And I think in Gethsemane, he is already starting to enter into. He is entering into the experience of enduring God's wrath. What is God's wrath? Well, we have to remember that God is the source of all that is good. So anything you enjoy in life is from God, and it's because of the presence of God. Whether it's food that you like to taste, or enjoying conversation with a friend, or sunsets, or sleep, or laughter or music or anything good that you have in life, anything we experience that is good is from God. And separately from that, as Jesus ends up defining sin, sin is when we live apart from God. Sin is when we live without regard to God. The wrath of God is God simply allowing us to be apart from him forever, to live without regard to him and to be pushed out of his presence forever. Which means that every sin is actually, in a sense, a foretaste of hell. Here's what it looks like. Take your favorite sin or your recurring selfish struggle. Vanity, control, pornography, bitterness, gluttony, anger. You can think of something right now. Or just take anything that we tend to seek more than God. Success, a spouse, the adoration of our children, comfort. Whatever we give ourselves to that is not primarily God, as we give ourselves to it more and more, it will actually end up giving us less and less pleasure and satisfaction. This is the case for any addiction. And the result is that we also have more and more guilt as we enter into it more and more, till eventually the guilt becomes so much that we have to turn ourselves off from it and we become hardened in our conscience and shut off from even the pleadings of God on our conscience. As we enter into our sin more and more, we find that there's actually less peace and less hope in our life, and more neurosis and anxiety. We end up turning more and more inward on ourselves. Sin is incredibly, incredibly isolating. It's self-destructive, and it ends up very hopeless. It is the path to hell. Think about it this way. Being critical is very natural for some of us because there are so many people in this world who can't do things right. Complaining about them feels good and is justified because they are idiots. But left unchecked, that critical heart feeds on our self-exalting pride. And over the course of time, we find that we no longer see stupidity in others, but we see intentional slights. They knew good and well what they were doing. Our criticisms and complaints over time form into a deeper bitterness inside of us, which of course makes us rather unbearable people, which ends up isolating us from people, which makes us more bitter and grumbling and completely alone, except for that critical set of thoughts, which ends up becoming a circle of self-loathing. This is what a critical spirit can look like in 50 years. Can you imagine what it would look like in, say, 500 years? Or 5,000? Or forever? I'm stealing directly from C.S. Lewis, who in The Great Divorce wrote this. Hell begins with a grumbling mood, always complaining and blaming others, but you're still distinct from it. You may even criticize it in yourself and wish you could stop it, but there may come a day when you can no longer. Then there will be no you left to criticize the mood or even to enjoy it, but just the grumble itself going on forever like a machine. He says elsewhere, there are only two kinds of people in the end, those who say to God, thy will be done, and those to whom God says in the end, thy will be done. So when Jesus is facing drinking the cup of wrath, what he's facing is something he has never experienced before, which is having God the Father, the source of all good, pull back from him. Because the wrath of God, the cup of God's wrath on all people, is God abandoning us to ourself, to our sin, forever. And in Gethsemane, I believe, Jesus begins to endure God's wrath on sin. God the Father is pulling back and beginning to abandon him. He's beginning to experience something he has never felt before, which makes complete sense of his extreme grief and sorrow and distress. You think about it. Grief, when we lose somebody, grief is greatest when the relationship is closest. Jesus had only experienced the fullness of God the Father, the fullness of God's presence, closer than any best friend or spouse or parent. He had experienced the fullness of the pleasure of God the Father his entire life. And it seems that in Gethsemane, Jesus begins to experience forsakenness. That is the real horror and agony of the cross. Forsakenness. Crucifixion is not worth comparing with forsakenness. Think about Jesus' overwhelming distress here, his words from the cross itself. What they tell us is that all the details about Jesus' crucifixion, that he was abandoned by his friends, betrayed by one of his closest friends, taken into a trial where he did nothing wrong and false accusations are coming to him. They ripped at his beard. They blindfolded him and beat him with rods. Then they stripped him naked and whipped him mercilessly with a leather whip filled with metal shards until his back was completely flayed. And then they made him carry a crossbeam through the city streets until they took him outside and they nailed the nails through his wrists and through his feet and hung him naked, suffering horrendously, bleeding and in deep pain, suffocating to death. And all of that, in all of its horror, is not worth comparing with God pulling back spiritually and having to endure his forsakenness for even 24 hours. In other words, it's better to be tortured to death than to endure hell for one day. And so Jesus says, "Let this cup pass from me. The cup of wrath that I am about to endure, that I am enduring even now in your presence as it's being pulled away from me, God, the Father." Yet he prays, "Not as I will, but as you will." And those are the great words to us, that Jesus submits his desires, his will to the Father's. Jesus submits his will to the will of the Father. That's the opposite of sin. Jesus obediently allows the Father to treat him as sinful so that we who are disobedient can be treated as righteous. In 2 Corinthians 5:21, Paul puts it this way: "For our sake, God made him, Christ, to be sin, who knew no sin, so that in Christ we might become the righteousness of God." God, in his justice, will allow us to go our own way to eternal forsakenness. If we want to live apart from him, he in justice will allow it. But God, in his mercy, sent Jesus Christ to be forsaken for us. That is the good news. You see, there are actually two cups in the Bible. There's the cup of wrath, and then there is another cup. The other cup is talked about in Psalm 23. It's the cup that overflows. It's mentioned in 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and called the cup of blessing. In Psalm 116, the psalmist calls it the cup of salvation. And on the night before he was crucified, Jesus Christ took the cup. And when he had given thanks, he gave it to his best friends and said, "Drink this, all of you. This is my cup of the new covenant, which is poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins. Whenever you drink it, which we do every week, do this in remembrance of me." Jesus accepted and obeyed the will of God by drinking the cup of wrath, so that we who disobey and reject God may by faith drink the cup of salvation. In Gethsemane, we see in Jesus' words and prayer and actions and emotions not something that should be confusing or embarrassing, but something that should be amazing and wonderful. It is good news. Jesus drank the cup. He became sin and experienced hell for us, so we don't have to. What do we do with this? I think Gethsemane calls us to wake up to the horror of sin and an eternity apart from God. It calls us to recognize in Jesus the God who knows us in all of our struggles and weakness and suffering. Gethsemane calls us to understand the depth of God's love for us, what he is willing to do for us. And Gethsemane calls us to come with faith to Jesus and to drink the cup of salvation. We do it every week, but you need to do it for the first time, some of you. We come by faith and say, I want that cup so I don't have to drink the other, which you drank for me. Let's pray. God, our Father, who sent your Son to die for us, not just to die a physical, horrendous death, to die experiencing the wrath that we deserve, the forsakenness which is ours. May we by faith come to the cup of salvation and trust that what you have done is enough and rest on your mercy and grace. Amen.
Still my soul, the Lord is on your side. Bear patiently the cross of guilt or pain. Leave to thy God to and provide. In every change he faithful will remain. Be still my soul, thy best, thy heavenly friend. Through thorny ways leads to a joyful end. Be still my soul, thy God doth undertake to guide thy future dance, let nothing shake. All now misty, you shall be bright as last. Be still my soul, the waves and winds still know. His voice to rule, and while he dwells.